Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. It's episode 238. My name is Rob Cope. I'm your host. And today we're talking to the incredible Norwegian saxophone player Marius Nesset. His new album, Giza, is being released on October the 27th, which is in just 4 or 5 days. This Friday, we're going to talk to Marius today about this incredible new album. It's called Giza. It's live at the Royal Albert Hall. It was part of the BBC Proms with the London Sinfonietta, as well as Jeffrey Patterson, Ivo Neem, Jim Hart, Connor Chaplin, and Anton Eger in his band. Before we start the show, we're going to have a listen to one of the tunes off of the album. This is called On Fire. Marius Nesset, welcome, sir, to the Jazz Podcast. How are you doing?
Thank you so much. I'm fine. It's great to be here.
Great to come and have a chat. We just had a listen to the second part of your new album of Giza called On Fire. So our listeners are ready to go. Can you tell us a bit about yourself, and then we'll chat about the music as well?
Yes, I'm a 38-year-old saxophonist living in Oslo. I used to live in Denmark, in Copenhagen, for many, many years. But I recently moved to Oslo the last years, and I have lots of different projects now, everything from solo saxophone to symphony orchestra projects, and basically pretty much between there. So, yeah.
How did you decide to move back to Oslo?
It was because of my girlfriend, who is from here.
Ah, nice. How is it there?
It's great. It's a bit different. It's much colder here than in Denmark.
I was just going to say, is it nice to be back? Because this is your homeland, isn't it?
Yes, it's great to be back. I'm actually from Bergen, in the west coast in Norway. So it's not really home. But it's still nice to live in Norway again, and I love the snow in the winter.
It's very interesting for me, being English, and I've been to both, luckily, and they're wonderful cities. But having lived in both, how are they different, Oslo, Copenhagen, the Danish culture, compared to the Norwegians?
I find the Danish culture a lot more relaxed, in a way. People are very relaxed. It's a very relaxed atmosphere in Copenhagen, and it's very nice. I think not many cities can beat Copenhagen in that way. And there's a lot of concerts, and the music scene is great in both cities, I think. So it's not that big difference, but it's still there is a kind of a different, I think.
So tell us about the music scene then. What's Oslo like as a sax player?
Good question. I mean, I mean, since I moved to Oslo, my life has changed quite a lot. I got kids and family, and so I don't have had. When I'm not on tour, I'm much more at home. So I'm not hanging out that much that I did in Copenhagen. So to me, Copenhagen was the place where I had a lot of musician friends and hang out and played with people. And it's a bit different life here in Oslo. And I'm pretty much playing with the same people that I have been playing with before I moved to Norway. But there's lots of amazing musicians here. It is. And it's a great music conservatory here. It's lots of exciting things going on.
How's the balance with having kids and having a career? How are you finding it?
Well, it's different. I have to start working like at 8 in the morning now. I finish like 3:30.
Yeah.
And I'm picking up the kids. So when I'm home, that's... But it's amazing how much you can do within these hours. You get much more structured. You have to. So that's... And of course, it's a bit more hard to travel and be away for a longer time. But on the other side, it gives me so much energy. And so I think it gives some other inspiration. And that affects the music also in a way. And that's my experience.
It's very interesting that it all, like, I find getting up early is like a huge bonus. Like, if I haven't started work by like 8 or 9, I'm already done for the day. I'm like, there's no point, you know, I'll just do it
exactly.
Tomorrow.
Yeah. it's exactly. What I get to do before 11 in the day is so incredible much. You never take that again the rest of the day if you don't. So that's great.
Yeah. Practice time, how are you finding cramming in? Because I find this a nightmare. I've got a little girl and like I just don't want to practice when she's around because I want to hang out with her, you know? So my practices are really short and like just long notes. That's about all, you know?
I know. I find that I love to get up early in the mornings if I have had good sleep, which is not every day, every night.
Yeah.
And then just to start working, ideally practice a bit and then I start composing and my brain is so fresh for those hours there. So I found it's interesting, but I don't think I have ever composed so much music and done so much since after I got kids. I'm thinking sometimes, what did I spend all these hours on before?
Yeah, so. I'm exactly the same. I've written more this year than ever before in my life, and I think it's because when I do have these little windows, they mean so much because you don't have an endless amount of time to experiment with.
No, exactly. And then finished work 3 or 4 in the days, and you get home and you just get a lot of energy being together with. I mean, that's the kind of, I mean, I'm traveling, of course, as a musician, but when I'm home, I can structure my day as I want, which is a luxury thing for many people. So, yeah, I can get really much time together with them, and at the same time, get done all the composing and the practicing, which is very nice.
How do you compose typically, or you know, how do you get started with new works?
I almost never have a big master plan in my head before I start composing. I just start to write. I sit down and start to write, or maybe I have some ideas that I got from somewhere. I start writing and then I say, then it develops a little, and suddenly maybe I have developed some kind of melody line or some chord changes or a rhythmic concept, something that I will start to develop more, and then gradually I can see more and more where the piece is, which shape is taking and where it's going, and then I can start to see the bigger picture in my head. But I'm trying to, especially in the first in the beginning of the process, I try to not get too much, spend too much time on small details. It's more to get the flow. And then I will go back spending hours and hours on very small details, and it can drive me crazy sometimes. But I think it takes really long time. I mean, I think I can compose some pretty good music in quite a short time. But if you want to really make it something different, something special, then you have to put very many hours into it. That's my experience. I'm not some, I can't just do that in hours. I need to spend really much time. I need to come back to it and come back to it and come back to it. And I will leave all my rules, concepts, just use my ears in the end. What sounds good, what doesn't sound good, and spend probably the thing I spend most time on is the form of the piece, the shape of it. It's which often do that. I have to throw away Kill Darlings. You know, I have to throw away parts of the music that I love, but that just doesn't fit into the piece. So. But the good thing is that can be the next idea for another piece, and then you have it rolling. I think that's pretty much how I work.
Would you work more at the piano or at the sax with your writing?
Both of them and none of them. I don't have anything that I do more often than the others. And often I just compose without touching neither the piano or saxophone before until later in the process. It's different from time to time. I don't have one way to do it. But I think that the more experienced I become, the quicker can I see this will not work or this will work. I mean, I'm getting quicker in some parts of it. At the same time, it's getting more harder because you don't want to repeat yourself. You want to do something that is a little new every time. I guess it's a lifetime learning process. And you hopefully getting a little better every day.
Yeah, I'm grateful that we do something that gets better with age, not like... Like if we were footballers, we'd be like right on the edge now.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. My career would be over the top now.
Yeah. So grateful for that. Let's talk about Giza. So your new album is out this Friday and it's a gorgeous cover you've got with like a hand-drawn Royal Albert Hall. How did this all come to be? This, because it was part of the BBC Proms, isn't it?
Yes. It was. It was a commission for BBC Proms I was contacted some years ago. And so I started to work on this piece in the autumn 2021. And the next half year was probably the most intense period of my life. I was more or less composing all the time for 10 months or something like that. At the same time, I had another commission. I was composing a flute concerto for the Norwegian Radio Orchestra, and my sister, that's a flute player, and I was touring like really much in Europe at the whole period because this was just when everything opened up after the lockdown. So all the tours had been. they suddenly came there all in once, and at the same time I got father to another girl, so it was so many things going on at the same time that, and I think that's also why I can't really plan like a piece like that, the 65 minutes piece. I can't really plan how it's going. I mean, I can have some idea, but all the things that happens in your life, and both things that you hear, music you hear, things you play, but also other things in your life that will affect the way I compose. So for this piece, it started with part seven. That was the first thing that I wrote. And I didn't know that was going to be like in the end of the piece. And it was very, almost like a celebration theme, very happy. And then things happened. So, and then I remember suddenly it became a war in Europe. And then it just was so dark, everything. So it felt so wrong to just continue to write that, have that kind of mood. So that affected the music for sure, in the direction it took. And you know, then a couple of months later, I became a father to the second girl, which so many emotions. So I think the way I compose is both based on intuition and also knowledge about music, about, I mean, theory, harmony, melodic structures, and etc. But also, it's a lot of emotions that you can't really, it's hard to touch and, you know, to explain. It's just, okay, it has to be like that because that's how I feel it. I can't really explain it. And then maybe someone else doesn't feel it that way. But that's how I, and then gradually the shape of the whole thing is getting born, and you can see what but I have tried to, of course, structure the whole thing before I wrote one note. When I was composing a saxophone concerto for a symphony orchestra, you know, they wanted me to write a text about the piece like almost 2 years before the gig, and I didn't know what to write because I hadn't written a single note. But I think what I wrote there, in a way, was in my head all the time when I composed. So it worked in a way, but at the same time, it of course came out very different than I was imagined when I thought that it before I had written one single note. So it's interesting. Writing music is different every time, and I don't understand it, but it's fun. It's some of the most fun thing. It's the most fun thing in the whole world, but it's also so hard.
Yeah, you must have looked back at that text you'd written and been like, "What is this?" Like 2 years later, with the piece done, yeah. You know.
Yeah, definitely.
So, did you orchestrate all of this as well? Because there's the London Sinfonietta playing with you. Had you done anything like that before?
Yes, I orchestrated everything. And I have done that before. We did...
You did the flute concerto, of course.
The flute concerto, yeah. And the saxophone concerto.
Right.
And I had done two different projects with the London Sinfonietta before. Viaduct. And Snowmelt. And also, I did another project with the Norwegian Radiocaster with my own group. And I've done several big band projects. So I have actually quite a lot of experience now in orchestrating. And I think it's very interesting. There's so many possibilities in coloring the music, and you always have to make decisions. And in a way, orchestrating is not really you can learn by reading about it. You have to do it to learn. How does that combination of instruments sound? How does that combination sound if they play unison, but the one instrument is playing softer than the other, etc. Stuff like that. You have to learn by experience, and you're gradually getting better for that as well. I also have done my music. I have some of my music getting orchestrated by others, like really amazing arrangers and amazing orchestrators. Which sounds fantastic, but different. And it's getting more their music as much as mine, which I love. But I also love doing it myself. It feels more personal in a way. And I it's just something that I always have done and just will continue doing.
What software are you using?
Are you like putting it all in computer and like listening back to it as you work?
You mean what? Which program I'm
yeah
working on? Yeah, I'm using Sibelius mainly. Sibelius, and sometimes I record things and Pro Tools or something like that and listen back to it. But I'm writing all the score and the parts in Sibelius.
Right, I love Sibelius. It's so fun. I just love like putting stuff in and listening to it back to see like what even is this. Sometimes, you know, the longer I can go without listening to it before I listen back, the more fun it is to, you know, just
Cool. It's dangerous to listen back to it all the time because it doesn't always sound in the real world the same way. So I try to not do that too much, but of course, really good help to
get the. Yeah, I have to ration it so that I don't, you know, I think I delete everything if I constantly listen back as well, you know, I have to have this feeling of like, oh, that doesn't sound right, but it's good fun.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us about the names then. So you've got the album called Geezer, but then a lot of these tracks like Waterfall, On Fire, Lava, Flow, Meeting Magma. What's the inspiration for all of these names?
I mean, this is the association with a geyser, the Icelandic thing that just, what's the word? You know, it's, I mean, if you can see a geyser in your head and you have all this kind of lava thing and all of these things that's under the surface, which is kind of one title. And that's some of them. I made a concept that that is actually in the music. It's that's repeatedly chewing the whole piece that is lying under the surface, and then it goes everywhere else exploding with sometimes a little, sometimes a lot. And the titles are pretty much inspired by that that kind of association that I got in my head when I was composing this. And I had just been to Iceland, and I thought it was a really nice kind of metaphor for what the music was about.
And the band, you've got a great mix of British and
sort of Scandinavian musicians here with Ivo Neame, Jim Hart, Connor Chaplin. These are all mainstays of the British scene. And then yourself and Anton Eger. How did you choose the band to be the one that it is for this?
Yes, I played with them for a lot of years, many of them. And Anton has been my kind of, We have followed each other since we were very young, or like since I was 18 years old, and we have played. There's no musician that I played so much together with as him, and we have not only played a lot together, we have practiced together, developed a lot of different ideas together. So he knows my musical language probably better than anyone else, and he's a drummer. Which is probably the most important, instrument in this music to have the right to get that the right guy on the drums. He understands my rhythmical language like 100%, and I never have to explain. For him, he just takes it. So, and then Connor Chaplin is an amazing bass player who has kind of, he can be on top of it on all these difficult rhythms in the same way as Anton, and Jim Hart and Ivo are just fantastic players, and I love that there is a place where they have a duo for some minutes. I think it's in part three on it, and which sounds just it's just incredible playing and listening. And they just, I have written the chords, but they're taking it to everywhere. And yeah, it's great.
That is amazing. I listened to that bit this morning. I was going to ask you about that and about, in general, the orchestrating for the band. Are they playing a lot of notation and then suddenly chords and then notation? Like, obviously, with the orchestra, you kind of have to set a certain amount of it in stone, I imagine.
There was, yes. The band is also playing a lot of notated things. I mean, it's orchestrated for the band as much as the orchestra. Yeah. So luckily, they are all really good readers. Yeah, so it's very notated music, actually.
Yeah.
And it's not really many places where I have written out just chords and a groove. It's very few places, actually. But
yeah,
those places where I have, then it would always be some, okay, no, we have a, there is a moment here, it might last for one or more minutes or so, and we're going to here. So it's very important. And I think that's the biggest challenge with this, when you have so many musicians from a different musical background, that you all kind of go in the same direction. And that's where Jeffrey Patterson, the conductor, comes in. He is, he has understood what we are doing as a jazz quintet, I think he said that himself. He finds it very fascinating to see how we work with rhythms and stuff like that, and to take that into the orchestra and how you then can use it in the to get the orchestra to understand this, what's going on, and go in that direction. And I think we are kind of it's pretty unique what he has done there. It's great.
So tell us about Outbreak. I'm going to play this to the listeners as the end track. This is the end of the album. Tell us about this tune.
It's written in 27 16th notes. It's written with a clave that is based on 4 8 notes, and then there is a dotted 8 note break, 4 8 notes again, a dotted 8 note break, 4 8 notes again, a dotted 8 note break. Now I'm telling you the secret of the groove, which is that of all these 8 notes, that then became 12 in all. The drums are playing on every third of them. So every second bass drum and then the snare drum. And this is actually not something that was new for me, because I've composed one tune on that concept before, which is a blues called Jaguar, that me and Anton actually did together some years ago. So it sounds almost like a groove in 4-4, but you can't really put the finger on. It's interesting if people can hear it. Doesn't matter. The whole point of it is to get this feeling of a groove that is a bit, what's going on now? It's almost, you never really get the hand of it. And then you have the very kind of tight phrases going over it, and we're building up and building to the kind of ending, which is the big climax in the piece. And there is a saxophone solo in the middle of that one as well.
Yes, I'm going to play it. I'm going to start before this saxophone solo as well, so that everyone can hear your beautiful saxophone and the amazing sound you've got. So this is Outbreak. This is from the new album Geezer, which is out this Friday. Thank you, Marius, so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast. It's been brilliant to chat.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.